You are listening to Apologetically Overthinking with Brad and Chad.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to Apologetically Overthinking. My name is Chad.
I'm Brad.
And today we have a very, very special guest who we are talking with today. Today we're talking with Carmela, who is a youth theater director, and we're going to kind of get the inside scoop, what it means to be a theater director, the inside processes of a director's brain that, well, most of us aren't privy to. So welcome, Carmela. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Chad and Brad.
So when I would do shows, and you could probably say this too, Brad, but, you know, the audition process is always very, especially if it's a new company, can be a little stressful for the actors because you want to make a really solid first impression. And if you're going back to a company where you know the director, you've done a couple shows with them, that audition feels a little less tense because you recognize, oh, they already know my basic skill set. They've seen me at my best. They've seen me at my worst. I don't need to really shine in this audition to the same extent as if I was auditioning for a new company. I don't know anyone. I don't have any good references. I don't know the directors. So give us some insight into if you are seeing someone, and maybe contrast it with someone who you've had in a lot of shows before. If you have a new student who is auditioning, what are you looking for? Are you able to see past their nervousness and maybe see they actually have some skill here? Does the nervousness totally cloud that? And the audition, generally, for most auditions, I know this is probably your experience too, Brad, is they're pretty short. So how do you gain all that information to make a casting decision, typically in a very short time frame, sometimes even the same day, right?
Right. I think what you were saying about it being a big difference between a new person and people you know definitely makes a difference. And you also need to know that it's nerve-wracking for the director, too. We usually do it, because we work with kids, we do it mostly with group readings. And they get to practice a little bit before, so you've already get a sense when they come out whether or not they're able to relate to the script and relate to the character. So much has to do with stage presence, of how comfortable they are when they get up there. Not only just comfortable, I've had a lot of people that are really nervous that still shine. Mm. It's really hard to explain it. It's sort of like knowing the script. And since I wrote most of my scripts, that helps a lot. Knowing the script real well, you already have a vision of what that character needs to be. And then you see someone out and fulfill that, it helps a lot. Sometimes you also see someone who changes it in a way you never thought of that you think is brilliant, and you go with that. So a lot of it is gut reaction. Mm-hmm. It really is. It helps a lot when it's someone you already know. I mean, when we're doing plays that I have a lot of the people I already work with, I already know beforehand when I'm casting, I already knew you were going to be the prince. You know, I already knew that you were going to be Little John in Robin Hood. You know, it's like you know beforehand. But sometimes it's a total surprise. And you get someone, I can remember this one girl I met in a grocery store. And her mother was talking to the cashier about how she wanted to do theater. This shy little girl. And so I butted in and told her about doing theater. Well, now she's a singer in Nashville.
Oh, wow.
She's one of those people that when she gets on stage, she's a totally different person.
Mm-hmm.
So you never know, you know. But it's fulfilling to see it happen,
yeah.
To see it come out.
That's an interesting point you bring up. I know my understanding is Michael Jackson is probably considered the greatest performer of all time, was the ultimate example of that, where people who knew him off the stage, super shy, not very social.
Right.
But the second he gets on stage, something clicks.
So, exactly.
To be able to see that in students is definitely something that's really cool.
And lots of times it's a surprise, you know. It's like I can remember when you did your first audition, you came out, you were nervous. And yet when you came out and did that monotone for Lord Monotone and Sousification, it was like, this is it. Mm-hmm. This is him. And you grew and grew and grew. So now you're a confident actor. It's really nice to see.
Yeah, that show is actually a little background. The first time that I met Chad.
Yeah, that's the first time we all did.
Production. That was my first show with it. I like what you said about kind of you have a vision for what you want the character to be, but it can be changed. And that brought me back when I was in high school, a junior year, my high school did a production of Chicago. And I wasn't in it at the time because I was playing baseball, but I was close with everyone that was in it, and I got to watch the show several times. It was great. But obviously Chicago the Musical stars Queen Latifah
right.
as Mama. And the girl that they cast for Mama could not have looked further from Queen Latifah.
Mm-hmm.
And she was amazing.
Yeah.
She still had that same energy, but also she brought her own little character to it. And it was so cool to see. It was one of those, you're reading the cast list, you're going, whoa, okay, I'm curious to see this. And then she knocked it out of the park.
It's amazing to see how people can interpret things. And I think, you know, directing style has a lot to do. I mean, you know, the directors that everything has to be exactly the way they want it. I think I'm kind of loose about that. I try to let, I sort of picture as I'm giving them an opportunity to, by being on stage, just to show their talent. And I try to sit back and let them move, and I only try to intervene if someone's way off base or if they need a little modeling and stuff. And the things that come out of it sometimes are amazing. Do you remember when we did It's Tough Being Prince?
Oh, yeah.
And Donovan ad-libbed that part about standing on the stool.
Yes.
It was like this little guy had to talk to this big prince, and so he improvised getting a stool and standing on it so he'd be the same height. It was brilliant. And we left it in because, you know, it added so much. And I love when the kids do that and add things to the story.
That was terrific.
It was hilarious.
You mentioned that if you'd already worked with a kid or you already worked with an actor several times,
mm-hmm.
maybe the audition process isn't as important as someone who's auditioning for the first time for
mm-hmm.
you. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Like, if someone's been in your show 3 or 4 times... Does it matter if they bomb their audition at all? How much? I guess the question is it 50-50 audition and what you already know of them, or is it teetering a certain way?
If it was somebody I know, I would say that definitely takes precedence because I know what they can do and I've already thought about it. If someone new, obviously, is a whole different thing.
Sure.
But I'm not sure I've ever had anybody bomb an audition. I can remember one time someone had a cold and he didn't want to sing, but I already knew he was going to be the lead because he's the lead. And now he's on Broadway, you know. But one parent criticized me for that. He didn't even sing and you cast him. Well, I knew him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, I don't think I've ever had anyone bomb, though. But I think if they did... If I already knew them, I wouldn't worry about it. Mm-hmm. I also sometimes, when passing out the roles for doing the audition, you know, like you read this, I try to give them the role I'm planning for them.
Sure.
So that way, people already see you in that and see what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't question so much whether you should be the person. Does that make sense?
For sure.
So you'll take an actor who you maybe know and think ahead of time, if they're auditioning for the show, I see them on the registration list. I'd like to see them read for XYZ.
Actually, I don't
parts.
Even see the registration list beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
I usually talk to people beforehand, okay. But it's just sort of as I'm going through the play and thinking out, how am I going to do the set? How am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? It just...
It comes together.
Yeah, it sort of fits. The whole idea of fit. And that's what I try to tell the kids when they audition, especially little kids who have a hard time if they don't get cast, because in this
mm-hmm.
world, everybody... get something.
Yep.
And that's not the way theater is.
Mm-hmm.
Theater, unfortunately, does have setbacks. That's why I never did the thing of the first 30 people get in.
Mm-hmm.
I think people have to learn that this is the process.
Yeah.
It sometimes can be really difficult. So then when I have to go back and read who's going to be in it, I try to talk about the fit and that whoever's chosen for this role seems to fit what it should be. And if you didn't, that doesn't mean you're not good. It just means you need to try again for another show.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully some of the little kids can learn from that. But plus, the more you audition, the more you're going to get better to be able to get into a show.
Mm-hmm. In those first-time auditions, you mentioned just confidence. Outside of general confidence, are there specific, I don't know, acting techniques or acting methodologies that you use to kind of analyze, or is the biggest thing for you in youth theater just seeing, do they have basic stage presence?
It's not just confidence. Most of it is stage presence, but it's not just the confidence of stage presence. It's being able to interpret the character.
Mm.
And, you know, not obviously from an audition being really intense about it, but, you know, these kids' plays, they're not like, we're not talking Shakespeare here. So, well, actually, we do some Shakespeare, but it's
but
sort
we
sousify like,
it, so it's fine.
Yeah, right. But it's sort of like that they, like when you did monotone, you got the essence of the part and you played the part. And that's more of what I'm looking for. Someone who's believable in the role And the confidence is a part, but it's not all of it, because that comes. Mm-hmm. Confidence comes with skill. Confidence comes with opportunity, repetition. So it's really more of how they interpret the character, mm-hmm. more than anything, I think. I'm trying to think if there's something else that would be the main thing with mm-hmm. me. I'm trying to think back to auditions and, you know, got so near the end of the time, we had mostly people we did know, so it mm-hmm. made it a lot easier a bit. Yeah. I think that's the big thing, though, with just seeing how they adapt to the script and to the reading and being with other people. Mm-hmm. Sometimes some actors are not ensemble people, and that can make it really difficult. I remember having a dancer once that was the most amazing, beautiful dancer, but she'd never danced with anybody else, so she couldn't do the rhythm. I don't know if the rhythm, she didn't work with the rest. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's the same thing with the acting. If you're just saying your part and not relating, because it's dialogue, it's conversation. And if they're not doing that, then it doesn't work. And seeing that makes a difference. Definitely does.
Sure. I've got another question about the casting process, kind of before we maybe shift gears a little bit. How much are you considering feelings during casting, during cuts, whether that be just, I don't want to hurt a kid's feelings, or can I take one sibling and not another? Are there maybe relationships throughout mm-hmm. the cast? Like, how do you navigate that while still trying to get the best show you can, and also maybe trying not to hurt people? Or are you like, sorry, that's the business?
No, I don't get that crass about it, but it is really hard, especially with the younger kids. The older kids have usually been in something or other. They understand it. The younger kids sometimes have a problem with it. And as I said, it is hard on the director, too. That's why some directors don't put up the cast list until Friday afternoon, so everybody's gone for the weekend, mm-hmm. right? You know, because yeah. it's hard to deal with it. As I mentioned before, rejection is a part of the theater process. Mm-hmm. And it's not something you're going to teach on purpose, but it does happen. That's why I do group auditions. And we usually have large casts, which helps that you don't have to turn away too many people. Also, I'm willing to adapt a script if I see someone who has potential, or if there's a situation where it has to be not necessarily brother and sister, but whatever. Sometimes people come as a set. That's mm-hmm. the only way it works. You can't cast one twin and not another.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it causes a real problem. So I lots of times will adapt for that. I remember one when I had twins, and I used one for the ghost of the person and one for the person.
Mm.
You know, trying Ooh. To pit people in. But ultimately, there are times when you do have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you get back to that gut thing of what works. What sometimes is hard with people we do know is the thing of where people want a certain role. Like, people come up and say, well, I really like to play that, and I like to play that. Mm-hmm. I remember, like, Joe wanted to be Don Quixote. I knew he'd be better with Sancho Panza.
Sure.
You know, or like, I don't know if you know this guy, but he wanted to be Lysander in Midsummer. And it's like, Demetrius is the tougher character. Demetrius is the one that has problems with Helen and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But Demetrius is a pain, but he also has to be likable. And he's the only one I knew that I felt could play likable and annoying at the mm-hmm. same time. So sometimes, you know, it doesn't always go the way people want, but it's all about fit and what's going to work. And that's, again, why we try to mention that. Feelings are a big part of it. There's sometimes you could go home and you can cry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely. I tried to protect my own as much as I could. I never read scripts before auditions. I know a lot of people do, because then you can have that whole conversation of, hi, my name's so-and-so, and I'm trying out for this character. I'd really love to be this character. And I found that if I read through the script significantly before I auditioned, there was going to be one character that I was like, I got to be this guy.
That's really interesting. I never thought of it that way.
I'd really want to be this villain, or I really want to be this mm-hmm. hero. And then if you end up cast as anything else, you're going to feel disappointed.
Yeah.
So for me, I was like, you know what? I'm just happy to be here. Mm-hmm. I just want a part. And sometimes, having not read the script, doing the group reads, the cold reads, you'd read a character that maybe you don't have a lot of experience with, and you'd kind of go, okay, mm-hmm. I like this character. Maybe I can be this character. And then you kind of get your hopes up for that. But then you're cast as a different character. There's still that excitement of, well, I get to learn this whole new character because mm-hmm. I haven't read the script yet.
Well, and sometimes it brings people back.
Because, yeah.
You know, how they look on a character, do a second reading.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never thought of it that way. I always have thought that if you read the script, you have an idea of the essence of the whole thing and how everything fits together. But I haven't thought about how that could actually make it even harder.
Oh, I'm sure that I should have read the script.
No, I'm not saying this is a good idea.
Don't take this as advice. This is just what I
never thought of it. It makes sense in a lot of ways. And you are really good at quickly interpreting what a character is supposed to be. Some people can't do that. I know when I was doing the Shakespeare Festival, sometimes it would really bother me that people learned a monologue, but they never read the script, so they didn't really know how the monologue fit into the essence of the story. Mm. You know, and would try to explain how that was important, but I can see what you're saying. That has some merit to it. I guess it depends on the individual. Did you always read them first? You know, most of the time, we didn't have them first.
That's true, and a lot of times, like, even with high school productions, it's a show that I've never heard of before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every now and then, you'll come across, like, oh, we're doing Chicago, or we're doing Matilda, and you know the characters. But, I mean, I did some shows in high school that... There were great shows. We did a great job with them, but I'd never heard of them.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I don't know how to prepare for this character. I don't know who this character is. I'm just...
What if it's a play you really are not into?
Hmm.
Well...
Like, when I did Sweeney Todd, I didn't really like Sweeney Todd.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the focus just becomes, let's have a good time.
Yeah, let's hone your craft.
Yeah, right. Let's have the experience of doing this show. Yeah. Let's have the experience of doing the show with my friends and find a character and find a way to make it mine. And if the character's really boring, find a way to make them interesting. Mm-hmm. Give them a funny walk. Give them some sort of accent.
Right.
Yeah.
Create your own backstory motive. Like, but there were definitely shows that I was more excited about than others.
Oh, definitely.
There's some you show up, you're like, you know what? This is what we're going to do, and we're going to make the best of it.
There's some shows that I was more excited about than others, definitely, you know?
Yeah. No, I'd say the same thing. There's some shows where it's, you would do the show by yourself with no other incentive just because you love that show so much. And for me, if I was to, like, pre-scan a show before I auditioned for it, it'd be almost more so I would watch a production of it as opposed to reading the script would be my... But there's definitely other shows that I've liked more or less than others, but exactly what you're saying, you make the most of it. You find ways where... Mm-hmm. And maybe initially, the thought of that show is, oh, I'm not going to enjoy this show that much. But then once you actually really dive into it, you find, okay, well, there were actually a lot of elements here that were really enjoyable that I wouldn't have otherwise anticipated, you know, heading into it.
Well, when we emphasize on the classic literature things, lots of times, you know, they can be rather dull.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I usually would read the book first and then start thinking about it in script and stuff, important themes, stuff like that. But sometimes we would add comedy, not full-blown stuff, but add something to it just to make it a little bit more entertaining. It's, like, hard to read, but yet when you put the stories together, you can make it much better.
Yeah. Shifting a little bit, you had mentioned that kind of gut feeling with your actors and whatnot. Running a youth theater company, certainly some kids, you see them for one show and that's all you'll see them for. Other kids, you'll have them come back season after season after season. You'll get to see them grow. You'll get to see them develop. Is there anything either in that development process or maybe just when you first saw that kid where you said, okay, this kid has potential, or this kid could really grow into something, versus, okay, well, this kid, if he really works hard, could be a decent actor, but I don't see the talent level where they would ever make this a career or they would ever really flourish into taking over principal roles or whatnot. Are there some indicators that you see in kids at any stage, really, where you're like, oh,
this kid? Well, we've talked about the ones that are obviously stars. You know, they get up there and they're ready to go. But sometimes it's difficult when, I don't want to say with someone mediocre, but they start off that way. And you have no idea, but, it's sort of like you reflect on the change more than you expect the change. Does that make sense?
Yep.
It's hard to see who's going to grow and who's not. I think it's more as I look back, I can say, wow, look what that person's become. Someone like Joe, you know, started off with me when I was a little kid. I had no idea what he was going to become.
Mm-hmm.
And he's become a brilliant actor.
Yeah.
You know, but seeing that happen is a really good feeling, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you try to nurture it, but you don't always know who's going to do it and who's not. I'm sorry I can't answer that better, but...
Yeah, so some of it's just kind of, even you as a theater director, you try and build it, but some of it is just inherent in the kid, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. And from seeing what other people do and seeing, you know, how you're directed and seeing how the shows go, understanding, they start to grow on their own. And, you know, the confidence we mentioned, but it's more than confidence. It's sort of like being able to express your talent. Mm. And that's something that develops over time. You know, being able to put yourself out there, mm-hmm. that's not always easy to do.
Yeah.
Especially when it's a difficult role.
Talent aside, were you kind of able to tell when doing a production, this is a kid that I know is going to come back and be a part of this community, be a part of this company's family? And on the flip side, were you able to kind of see kids and go, this show's going to end and I'm never going to see you again?
There were some I hope not. You know? Yeah, I think you can by how much enthusiasm they have, how much they want to be a part of things, how much they try, how much they interact with the other cast. That's a big part of it, is like if you become part of the community, mm-hmm. and they start making suggestions of things and shows or way things act and stuff, or start talking about what's going to be the next thing. Some people just automatically, you can see it because you can see they belong. Others, you can tell they just get through it and that's it. They, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, I remember one person I had who came and she came with a friend and she only wanted to be on crew. And she ended up being brilliant. We had to bring her in because somebody quit last minute and she had to come in. She ended up playing Roxanne and she ended up playing Cinderella.
Wow.
She was brilliant, you know. So, I don't know. You can't always tell, but you sure hope they'll come back,
mm-hmm.
except the difficult ones. Hopefully they'll come back.
Just doing the best you can to just roll with those punches.
Exactly.
So it sounds like there's a lot of moving parts, even within the cast, when a show's in production, you're trying to get everything going. Are you ever able to just sit back and enjoy it? Or is it just go, 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 I got to focus on this, worry about this, make sure this person's doing the right thing? Are you ever able to sit back and go, I wrote this show and we're putting it together? That's pretty
awesome.
Not
until at least the second production, the second performance. The first one, you're sitting there and, okay, well, would they remember to do this, there? Oh, they forgot to move the curtain, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
But there's a point, I think it's really hard as the director, just like with anything, of being able to see all the parts come together. It's like the forest for the trees. Seeing the gestalt is really difficult. And if you can get to that point, then I can really sit back and enjoy it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it takes until the show is over and everybody's taking bows before I realize, yeah, this is really good. And mm-hmm. I do get a lot of satisfaction out of knowing that I wrote it and that people like it. That definitely is a good feeling.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
Would you say, maybe it's a combination of things, but kind of the most rewarding things of running a theater company, and particularly a youth theater company, I mean, it might be a combination of things, but in your experience, what's kind of been those things that have...
Rewarding.
You know, we've already touched on them a little bit, but just kind of as you reflect back on running your company, like what really brought about a lot of satisfaction and fulfillment in that process?
The most rewarding thing to me is watching kids show and develop.
Hmm.
You know, to see how they develop, to see how they love it. Seeing kids enjoying theater. You know, I also sell my plays online,
mm-hmm.
and every time I hit 100, because I don't sell individual copies, I sell the play as a whole thing. So whenever I get to 600, 700 sold, I think about that 700 plays times 30 kids per play times, that's like 21,000 kids enjoying theater, and that mm-hmm. is a really good feeling to me. That's the most rewarding thing. And getting feedback from kids and parents and seeing my writing being brought to life, that's
mm-hmm.
very, very exciting to me. The challenging, it's what you were saying about trying to bring everything together,
mm-hmm.
trying to listen to everyone's concerns
mm-hmm.
while still remaining true to the vision. And as I said, I'm very willing to change some things, but sometimes when you have things like working with the script, working with parents,
mm-hmm.
various actors who definitely, most of the actors we have been really good. We haven't
mm-hmm.
gotten too many prima donnas. Crew, sets, and making sure everything comes together, the props, the choreography. I can remember one time when the props disappeared, someone had moved things over, and it's like, last minute, what are we going to do? Or, you know, sometimes there's rules of things you can do and can't do. Actually, this one isn't mine. This was my daughter's, but they told her she couldn't use cap guns for when the kids were doing Lone Stranger and Pronto.
Mm.
So they used bananas. And it was the funniest thing in the whole world. So one kid ate his banana. So.
Oh, gosh.
But, you know, sometimes you have to adapt for all those things. That can be really challenging, trying to make everything fit at the same time you're considering everyone's feelings.
Yeah.
And as an actor, you got to be able to adapt too to all the changing things. And I mean, your vision of your character might differ from your director's of your castmates. But you remind me of one of just the biggest fiascos and one of my favorite stories to tell now. I was in a production of Romeo and Juliet my junior year of high school. And if you're familiar with the story, it doesn't have the happiest ending, right? It's a murder-suicide. And a very important prop would be Romeo's dagger.
Right.
Because he comes on, finds Juliet dead, drinks his poison, collapses. She gets up, goes, oh my gosh, what's happened? Stabs herself with his dagger. It's really hard to do when I forget to bring the dagger on stage.
adapting and ad-libbing are so hard.
Yeah, it was this great, passionate, sad moment, and I fall dead, and I realize I don't have the dagger. And we had to improvise the rest of the way. Juliet was great. She ended up taking the poison bottle and smacking herself over the head with it. it was funny, but it was just...
Those types of things. I remember one time when we did Christmas Carol, and the one that was playing the Ghost of Christmas Past was funny crazy. She was working with... Ebenezer Scrooge was someone that she went to school with. They were very, very good friends. And she kept throwing glitter everywhere. I got in trouble for glitter on the stage, of course. Everywhere. She got it in his mouth and he couldn't say his lines.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, no.
It was hilarious. So he had to spit it out and she had to keep ad-libbing through the thing. But those things happen. And sometimes they're brilliant.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I've noticed now when I go to different places, I can almost see when that's happening.
Mm.
You know? You can sort of see, oh, something's a little different here. Yeah, sure. I think that's hilarious that you did that.
Oh, that was pretty good. So circling back a little bit, this is an awesome opportunity for the Brad and Chad podcast. We're able to talk not only to a director, but a writer. And so walk us through your process a little bit when you're creating a new show. Are you writing it linear? Do you have a start, middle, end? Are you writing up certain characters first, getting their lines in? Like what's the process of writing something that ends up on stage?
I tend to write linear. Usually since ours are based on classics, classic literature, classic fairy tales, whatever, I read it first. Read the book. And sometimes that's easy. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's not. I mean, Don Quixote's very long. Dickens is very dry. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of like to get the essence of the whole thing. And then I sort of let it all gel in my head and start interpreting into, okay, what are the... You can't obviously do every scene in the book. Right. So which ones are the most important ones to do? You know, which of the characters are important? And then you have to start thinking about changing the sets and the props and, you know, dividing it into scenes. So I usually end up outlining. You know, I think about all the characters and the scenes are usually based on different things within the book. And then translating that into dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that's tricky too, because just as much as you can't include every scene, you can't steal the lines word for word. So you have to find a way to rewrite.
You can if it's written before 1923, then considered in public domain. You could take a Shakespeare play and publish it, and you could get away with it because it was before 1923.
Interesting.
I try not to do that. Well, partly because part of the reason we're doing this is so kids can understand the literature, mm-hmm. and so you don't want it to be too confusing. The dialogue is tricky when you first start, and then it just sort of becomes a way of life. You know, that's the way you write it. When I wrote my book, someone said, boy, this book has a lot of dialogue. And it never dawned on me that I did that because I'm so used to doing dialogue. But anyway, then once I get the whole outline and the idea down, then I start writing. And then, of course, I revise and change and add here. And then I have my daughter read them because she's brilliant and knows what she's doing. And then go back and revise again until... And then when we're doing it, I revise again. I mean, you've seen how many times I've added stuff to plays.
Yeah.
You know, just because of the people involved and their abilities or just to add essence to the whole thing, mm-hmm. you know.
What about monologues? Do you enter it or even enter your outline with, I want to give this character a monologue, I want this character to have a monologue, I want this character to have a monologue, or is it like, oh, this, I've reached a point now where it would be really cool for this villain to go off on this tangent where they explain their whole plan before the world explodes or whatnot? Or is it more of a...
I guess I haven't planned it. it's sort of like what it needs to be at the time. Like I remember in Legend of Sleepy Hollow, there's one where father of one of the places Ichabod is staying is telling some story, and it was rather long, but I never thought about it as being a monologue. And there's some things, of course, when you're doing things like Macbeth or something, you obviously include monologues because they're already there, but I just sort of do what it needs to be. And sometimes if something's too long, I'll have another character say something in between just because it's kids, remember?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I know one of the kids wrote Hunchback in Notre Dame, and I helped him revise it because it was monologue. Big, huge parts, and we added things in between to make it more readable. But I never thought about putting it in that way. It just sort of happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Taking a large chunk of text and not just making it more understandable in terms of the language use, but also considering maybe not attention span, but just kind of
memory.
How kids memory, exactly, like breaking things up and still trying to maintain, obviously, because with all your stories you're still trying to maintain the essence of, you know, you don't want to, I would assume your goal is never to change something so much that it seems like an entirely different story, like that's
exactly,
you know,
that would change the whole point of why we're doing it.
Yep.
You know, but
so this is a question that us college students typically have a lot. And the question is, how much of what you go to school for actually impacts what you wind up doing in your career versus how much of it is, okay, I went to school, but looking back on it, most of what I do now is off of my real life experience and not off of school. So I guess just quickly mention like kind of what you went to school for and how that impacts or doesn't impact what you do versus just kind of your experience.
This is really interesting because I didn't study acting.
Okay.
You know, my background was in, my undergrad was a major in history and liberal arts, and my master's was in deafblind education, kids with multiple disabilities, which is what I did for years. And actually, that's what got me started. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, my biggest influence is my daughter because she was in plays all growing up and she studied theater and she probably taught me 90% of one. And she taught me all the words, you know, what backstory means, what this means, what that means. So I learned a lot from her. But what got me started writing is when I was teaching, I was working with kids with severe disabilities and their reading was very limited. We mostly emphasized functional words they needed to know to be as independent as possible in the environment, like, you know, produce in the grocery store or health and beauty, things like that, doctors, things like that. But my kids wanted more, even though they couldn't learn more, plus the big emphasis on authentic learning and all that. Mm-hmm. So they, in order so they could read a lot of the stories or know a lot of the stories their friends knew, I started writing them into plays. Mm-hmm. Because by acting them out in a language they could understand, they were able to understand the story. Mm-hmm. By being part of the story, you learn to understand the story. So that was a big part of where my background came from. It definitely was experience. And I always wonder which is better, too. I mean, I think looking at Megan has both. She's obviously much better than I will ever be, but I do think you can learn a lot from experience, too. And the fact that you all have background already makes a big difference.
So with the company, with all that you've done, all the shows that you've written, produced, directed, starred in, all of it, well, there may or may not have been a dinner theater that you played a very big role in. But what are the top memories? What are the top productions? Which ones do you look back at and either go, this was a really good show, or this was a lot of fun?
I think my favorite in terms of the craft and being beautiful production stuff was A Midsummer Night's Dream. We were fortunate enough to have a lighting person, which we never used to have, who did tremendous things and an amazing set and an amazing cast. And it's like just looking at the pictures, it was really well done. Another favorite definitely is Don Quixote because I love the story. And it was so much fun. Cyrano de Bergerac, I love that story. And that's was really fun. The Odyssey, which I never thought I would really like. Actually, Megan wrote that one. I didn't think the kids would like it. And they came in and Megan said, we're doing the Odyssey. Oh, we just read that in school. Yay.
Oh, fun.
You know, so it worked out really well. And it ended up being an amazing production because, again, we put in enough humor to get the kids through some heavy parts and stuff. Wizard of Oz. Tough Being the Prince is probably one of my favorites because it was my first and it was my 50th.
Wow.
The difference is amazing. The first time we did it, I was so nervous and the kids were nervous. And we had no music, well, just background music. Mm-hmm. We was done in half an hour. So half an hour was not long enough, you know. Mm-hmm. And then this last one, it was over an hour.
Oh,
we had
yeah.
singing and dancing and everything. So that's, I guess, a good example of how we adapt.
Mm-hmm.
But I just love that show. I think it's fun.
That was so much fun.
Sue's Vacation. Sue's Vacation of Romeo and Juliet, I did not write. I've always wished I had.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that show.
That was a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. It's just a great show. So.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in for this episode of Apologetically Overthinking and our conversation with Carmela. You can find Carmela's website in the show notes. It's classicacts.net. Let us know if you guys liked this style of content, like this style of podcast, more conversational. Shoot us an email, bradandchadpodcast@gmail.com. That's bradandchadpodcast@gmail.com. Or drop us a DM or a comment on our Instagram @bradchadpodcast. And yeah, we'll see you guys in the next one.